This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Chances are good that you came in contact with something made from recycled material today. A can of soda, the carpeting in your office building, or the smartphone that is an arm's length or less away. They are all part of a swirling cycle of old items fed back into the production of new stuff. And the more we buy, the more we need to recycle. But where does all of that recycled material ultimately end up? Adam Minter is Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg View. He followed the trail of trash and found that most of it ends up in China and India. He's author of Junkyard Planet, Travels in the billion-dollar trash trade. And we spoke with him when the book was first released. It's now out in paperback. A billion-dollar trash trade. Who is profiting from all that waste?
Well, it's everybody from the local scrapyard down the street in New Hampshire there to large-scale exporters of scrap metal and paper on the West and East Coast ports like Los Angeles and in New Jersey. And more than ever, it's Chinese scrap metal importers and processors, the people who are bringing in it's just $40 billion of American recyclables annually and transforming them into products that range, as you said, from cardboard boxes to automobile parts. It's an extraordinary story. It's the hidden story of globalization, and it's only growing.
The scale is huge. But my question, why does the U.S. export that waste to places like China instead of just recycling it here?
Sure. Well, the simple answer is that the U.S. just simply generates more recycling, more waste than it's capable of processing at home. On average, the U.S. exports about 40% of the recycling that it generates. And most of that recycling isn't, despite what most people may think, put into your recycling bin. It's recycling that's generated in factories, printing plants, by power companies when they replace new cables. And a lot of that kind of material, it's just too much excess of it to be handled in U.S. manufacturing facilities. So, for example, in China, they have the largest copper manufacturing industry in the world. So if you have a power line, more likely than not, that power line was manufactured in China. And so, in a sense, the story of recycling today is a story not just about recycling, but it's about manufacturing. As we all know, China's become the manufacturing juggernaut of the world, and because of that, it needs raw materials, and recycled materials are the cheapest and most efficient raw materials out there.
Is there an alternative to sending waste overseas? What you do in the book is paint this pretty stark scenario, environmentally speaking, an increase in mining for ore. So talk to us a little bit about those trade-offs.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that I state in the book, and I believe it quite strongly, is the worst recycling, and there's some very environmentally damaging recycling, is still better than the best mining. And by that I mean, simply this. Digging a hole in, a Tibetan mountainside to dig out copper ore is an invariably very, very destructive and very dangerous activity. It's far safer and far cleaner to ship a bunch of power lines from the United States to South China, where they can be stripped, not necessarily in factories that meet, U.S. health and safety standards, but certainly much healthier, safer, and much less environmentally environmentally destructive than digging massive holes in the ground. And that goes for plastics, which require some very dangerous facilities to recycle, but they tend to be lighter on the environment than digging an oil well, say, in the South China Sea. These are very hard decisions and very hard choices that we all have to face as consumers and as people who consume raw materials. They're not black and white, despite how they tend to be depicted in the mainstream media, that exporting your recycling to China is bad. As I tell people, China is going to manufacture stuff. They're going to make new iPhones. They're going to print books, and they're going to get the raw materials to do that. So we have to ask ourselves, how would we like them to get those raw materials? If we cut off the flow of recycling from the U.S. to China, they're going to go get those raw materials somewhere else. I think there are ways to encourage China to do better, and they have been doing better in the 11 years I've covered the industry. There's a long way to go, but compared to what the situation could be, I think the recycling system is very good.
Well, Adam, one of the things that just shocked me is how many people in the world are employed in this recycling business.
Yes.
Can you give us any idea of the numbers?
Well, the actual numbers are really hard to come by, and they're really variable because it depends on how you look at it. But after agriculture, the activity which occupies more people than any other in the developing world is recycling. And that may be just going through people's trash bins and working as a peddler, because that's basically the job opportunity of last resort, to working in some of the highly industrialized facilities that I show in the book, both in pictures and write about. So if you can come up with total agricultural employment, it's a number less than that. And it's just absolutely astonishing. The longer you spend in the developing world, how many people you actually see engaged in this.
We're speaking with Adam Minter, Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview and author of the new book, Junkyard Planet: Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. How has the global economic crisis that began in 2008 affected the scrap export industry here in the U.S.?
Well, 2008 was a watershed moment for the global scrap industry, and especially for the U.S. industry itself. For the better part of 15 years, the U.S. industry had grown significantly because of China's demand for raw materials. But when the global economy collapsed, China's demand for raw materials collapsed. Remember, China's an export economy. They need markets to sell the stuff they make, everything from the iPhones to the books they print. Well, when U.S. consumers and EU consumers stopped buying all that stuff, the Chinese stopped demanding raw materials, and as a result, all of the recyclables that had been flowing to China basically stopped. And you had a situation in the U.S. where recycling warehouses were filling up with cardboard with nowhere to send it, because the Chinese simply didn't need it anymore. And a lot of people were appalled, towards the end of 2008. These recycling warehouses simply didn't have anywhere else to send the stuff, so they started sending it to landfills and incinerators. And that was also something that was occurring in the EU. To this day, as we all know, the global economy hasn't completely recovered from 2008, and neither, for that matter, have scrap exports from the U.S. or the EU. They still lag from where they were in 2007, which was the biggest year ever of the global recycling industry. If things continue as they do, it looks like things will be back to normal, or whatever normal means, in 2014, 2015. But it's, as I said earlier, the story of globalized recycling is really a story of manufacturing, and that's a story of how much people want to consume. In 2008, people stopped consuming, and as a result, the world stopped recycling.
How about now, though, Adam? You're giving us this picture of what you call sludge-filled landfills, burning plastic, a picture that we don't necessarily want to see when we're buying something on the supermarket shelves. And recently, you had an interview with Atlantic Cities and said, stop buying so much crap in the first place. Can I just say cynically, good luck with that. Are we really going to jam up the system, especially if there's so much legacy waste?
Oh, I agree with you completely. I mean, I want an iPhone upgrade, too. I want a new car, too, And I also feel that people in China and India should have the right to those things as well. There's no getting around getting people to stop buying stuff. What I encourage people to do, and I encourage them towards the end of the book, is start thinking about products that last longer, that can be repaired and upgraded, that don't need to be cycled out every 18 months. In the end, you're only holding off the garbage man and the recycling man for a little while longer, but it's a more practical approach, shall I say, than, telling people to stop buying so much crap. But when I said that to the Atlantic Cities, I was sort of getting at that point.
Adam, you come from a family with scrap dealers in your history.
Sure.
Were you raised to recognize the value of trash and scrap? I mean, did your family recycle before everybody else was doing it?
Yeah, well, I like to say we recycled before anybody had ever heard the word recycling. The word recycling came in the 1920s, and my grandfather was already recycling on the streets of Minneapolis in the 19-teens.
Huh.
You know, so it was. I mean, it's very much a part of the family ethic.
Adam, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was our earlier conversation with Adam Minter, Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg View and author of Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The luxury market is expected to do very well this holiday season. Perhaps you're considering an 18-karat gold new iWatch at about $12,000 for someone very special in your life. If paying that amount of money for a watch made by a computer company gives you pause, imagine paying nearly $10,000 for a cell phone. Enter the Aster, a new offering created specifically for women from the high-end phone company Virtu. Before you take out a loan to buy one, you'll want to hear what our next guest has to say. Gabriel Roth took the Aster for a test drive at one of Virtu's upscale boutiques and wrote about the phone for Fast Company. We spoke with him earlier this fall to get a review. Gabriel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the price range for this phone?
Well, the low end of the Aster is $6,900. The most expensive of the basic models costs $9,700. And then if you want to get a customized or personalized version, they wouldn't give me a top end. So I think we can assume it's pretty high.
So what makes this phone so expensive?
In terms of the components and the hardware, there's nothing especially surprising about this phone. It's exactly the same sort of thing you would get from a high-end iPhone or Android phone. It's a touchscreen device. It runs the Android operating system. It'll be a very nice phone, but there's nothing to make it 10 times as expensive as a top-of-the-line iPhone. What makes it stand apart? Number one, it's upholstered in extremely expensive kinds of leather, which are made from ostrich or snake or calfskin in fashionable colors that are designed to appeal to contemporary tastes. But I think more to the point, what makes it stand apart is this is an attempt to apply luxury branding of the kind of thing that we see in the apparel or handbag industries to cell phones, so that in the same way that a Louis Vuitton purse might cost $5,000, even though the materials might cost only a fraction of that, this is a cell phone that's designed and priced along the same lines.
Well, I can imagine test driving a $300,000 Bentley would be a very different experience from test driving a $15,000 Toyota Yaris, right? It's going to reveal some differences in performance and handling and comfort. Would I notice a difference between my iPhone 6 and the Aster?
Not in the same way as a Bentley, certainly. You might notice that it feels pleasingly heavy in your hands. The sides are gently beveled to accommodate your fingertips. The screen is maybe a little brighter, and it's certainly bigger. It's in between an iPhone 6 and a 6 Plus. But the thing about a cell phone is the controls, the buttons, are all part of the software. They're all part of the touchscreen. And so the feel of using it in your hands isn't going to differ from using an iPhone or a regular Android phone all that much. That's just outside of Virtu's control.
Well, I can imagine maybe, you know, buying a really expensive Philippe Patek watch or something like that so I could hand it on to my child or something like that. Now, these Virtu phones are supposed to be handcrafted by an individual craftsman. Wouldn't I rather have some techie in the Silicon Valley who does this all year design my phone?
Well, first of all, we need to differentiate between designing and assembling it. These phones are designed by technological designers, same as any other phone. But you know what these craftsmen are doing replaces the work that's done by an assembly line of workers in China at a plant like Foxconn. Rather than having one person install one component and then pass it on down the line to the next one in the industrial process that's been with us since the days of Henry Ford, Virtu phones are made. Each one is put together by a single person. The idea, I suppose, is that it gives it a sort of handcrafted feeling, but it's not clear to me how the result would be any different.
You also found that there's an added bonus of 6 months of complimentary concierge service, which is kind of like a live human being of Siri, you know, booking your plane tickets and getting restaurant reservations, which did strike me as odd. If one's wealthy enough to buy this phone, are you going to trust a phone company to be your personal assistant?
I think that's a really good question. I think most of the buyers of this phone aren't actually going to be using that service as much as one might imagine or as much as you or I would if we were to have a personal assistant available on call.
So who's the market for this? The Russian oligarchs, you know, the Kardashians? Are people actually buying them?
There were earlier Vertu models that seemed to be targeted more at that demographic. They had more a sort of louder, more blinged out look. There were jewels all over them and things like that. These ones have a more refined appearance, and they seem to be for the same sort of consumers who buy those expensive purses and those expensive watches and want other people to notice, but not to think that they're gauche or obvious, to think, oh, this is a person who really has expensive, lovely, classy things. I don't know if the cell phone market is really a place where those people are going to go to purchase those kinds of luxury items. But Vertu is doing very well, and I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing other manufacturers start appealing to that same demographic pretty soon.
Did it work on you, Gabriel? I mean, did you walk into the boutique and, you know, like buying a Gucci bag for a lot of money, get individualized attention and a sense that the salesperson was a greater human being than yourself?
It didn't have that effect on me, no. And I'm sort of immune to the allure of those luxury brands. It's not something that I particularly covet. And so I walked in and out of there feeling like the whole thing was pretty ridiculous. But I also walked out of there feeling like, well, this is the way economics is going. This is the way the American market is going. There are more and more obscenely wealthy people who have enough money to spend on things that don't really increase their quality of life at all. But what else are they going to spend all of that money on? And companies more and more are going to be producing products that are designed to appeal to them rather than producing products that might actually be an improvement on what came before. And I think that's kind of sad.
Gabriel Roth, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Author Gabriel Roth, not speaking to us on the Aster, by the way. His debut novel, The Unknowns, is now out in paperback. And we found his article, The Bentley of Cell Phones at Fast Company. If you'd like to check out some of these high-end cell phones, we've posted photos on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And from cell phones for the ultra-rich to cellular technology in the developing world. If you live in sub-Saharan Africa, your chances of getting a prescription for your pair of eyeglasses are next to impossible. There's only one optometrist for every 8 million people. But a smartphone can help, so says a professor at MIT. The World Vision Report's Cynthia Graber went there to check out the story.
Okay. Hi, I'm Ramesh Raskar. I'm associate professor at MIT Media Lab.
Raskar heads up a team that's developing a new way to measure eyesight.
2 billion people in the world have a refractive error.
Refractive error is a term for vision problems, anything from nearsightedness to astigmatism.
And according to WHO,
the World Health Organization,
about 500 million don't have access to eye care. And many of them are blind simply because they don't have access to optometrists and ophthalmologists who can prescribe them the right pair of glasses.
There are very few optometrists in the developing world. For example, in sub-Saharan Africa, there's one for every 8 million people. And the machines used to diagnose eyesight problems are bulky and cost thousands of dollars. There are organizations out there that bring eyeglasses to the poor, but aid workers have to schlep around hundreds of pairs of glasses to try to accidentally find one that might work for someone. That's heavy, expensive, and it doesn't always work. But what if they could diagnose the problem and then provide the exact correct pair? What if they could do all this on a cell phone?
Can I try this? Can I see how it works?
I look through a small plastic eyepiece that's hooked onto a smartphone. Raskar's developed technology in the eyepiece that breaks up an image into six different parts and sends it to six different segments of my eye. But all I see through the eyepiece are some parallel lines on a cell phone screen.
And your task is to align the bottom of the green line with the top of the red line. And if you have normal vision, they would already look almost aligned.
Aligned like on top of each other?
On top of each other.
What do I need to do to try to make them line up?
As you're looking through this eyepiece, your task is to click on the keyboard of the cell phone till those lines are aligned. And the number of times you have to click indicates to us what your refractive error is.
I click a couple of times.
They're now touching each other.
Yeah.
But let's see if I can make them. Now they're on top of each other. So if I took three clicks to make them line up, what does that mean about my eyes?
A three click in this particular case would mean you have a refractive error of 0.9. It means anything beyond 1 meter is slightly blurred for you.
Interesting. Because nothing looks blurred for me.
Yikes, I thought my eyes were perfect. Raskar says maybe I needed to take a little more time before I started clicking. And anyway, he says that in the field, eye patients would do this test 8 times with the lines in different orientations to figure out just what's wrong with their eyes. And then a cell phone app computes exactly what eyeglass prescription each patient needs.
So we're already pretty close to what a high-end machine will give you.
This project couldn't have been done even, a couple of years ago.
Today's cell phones have a resolution that's down to 30 micrometers. That's smaller than the width of a human hair.
And how does that help you?
It helps us in many ways. The resolution of your cell phone is directly proportional to the accuracy we can achieve.
So, to sum up just how simple this could be in the field, an aid worker would only have to be trained to explain to patients how to use the device. Everything else is done automatically. And then an aid group could bring the right prescription glasses to the people who need them.
When I talk to people who have worked in Peace Corps or have been overseas, they have told me that simply having a pair of glasses can completely change people's livelihood.
Raskar hopes to be able to change the lives of millions of people. Right now, the cost to add on the technology is a couple of dollars per phone, but he says when it's produced on a larger scale, it could come down to just a few cents. The device is being field tested and is already in use at an eye institute in India. Raskar says it could be widely available within only 6 months. For the World Vision Report, I'm Cynthia Graber.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. While we may not remember birthdays or much from high school chemistry or civics class, just about any American born between 1950 and 1985 can sing every word to this song.
The mate was a mighty sailing man, the skipper brave and sure. 5 passengers set sail that day for a 3-hour tour. A 3-hour tour.
Whether it's a catchy theme, like that of Gilligan's Island, or an image, think Mary Tyler Moore tossing her cap into the air. Some memorable credit sequences far outlast the shows that they open. TV critic Alan Sepinwall and his colleagues at HitFix compiled a list of the 25 greatest TV opening sequences of all time. He joined me this summer to discuss the elements of a truly great opening sequence. Alan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me. I knew exactly what song you were going to play as soon as you started talking about
it. How'd you guess?
It's just that's one in the DNA. The only other even possibility was Brady Bunch, which is also a Sherwood Schwartz show. There were a lot of shows like those in the 60s and the 70s, respectively, that were of comparable quality and style, but those two survived because everybody remembers those songs.
Well, I got to say, I noticed some personal favorites were not on your list, but I'm going to dive right into what you and your colleagues came up with. According to HitFix, what is the number one opening sequence?
The Simpsons.
The Simpsons.
What puts it at the top?
Well, I think part of it is people love The Simpsons, but also just it's the Danny Elfman score. You get this just collage of life in Springfield, so many images going by so quickly, so many gags packed into it, even more so the last few years since the show shifted to a high-def version of the credits. So there's just so much information and comedy packed in there and a sense of the show on top of this score, which, you know, is 25, 26 years old now and still holds up and still completely conveys the show.
All right. So what purpose should a great opening sequence serve?
It should do a few things. One, it should make you excited to watch the show that follows. There's a lot of really bad shows I grew up watching in the 1980s that it didn't matter the quality of them because I was just so into the theme song, you know, Greatest American Hero, T.J. Hooker, you know, Magnum, things like that. So that should be one. Two, ideally, it should either give you a sense of what the show is about, whether that's a basic plot explanation like you get from something like Gilligan's Island, or, you know, something that conveys the mood of the show, like Rockford Files, which is sort of wistful and wry and funny, and it's not like we're going to be taking this private detecting thing too seriously. or sometimes you just want something that's really interesting to look at and listen to. HBO had this show called John from Cincinnati, which premiered the night that The Sopranos ended, and nobody liked it, and nobody could understand it, and yet you watched the opening credit sequence, and it's fabulous, and it's hypnotic, and you kind of wish that the show that followed had lived up to that.
All right, let's dig into some of those, the three categories that you just mentioned. First, opening credits as expository device. So that's, you're kind of telling the story. The Beverly Hillbillies tells you what happened. Jed, you know, found a stream of bubbling crude and moves with his crew to Beverly Hills. Here's another one, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Let's listen.
In West Philadelphia, born and raised, on the playground is where I spent most of my days. Chilling out, maxing, relaxing, all cooling, all shooting some b-ball outside of the school. When a couple of guys who were up to no good started making trouble in my neighborhood. I got in one little fight and my mom got scared and said, you're moving with your auntie and uncle in Bel-Air.
It seems to me, Alan, that this category has somewhat fallen out of fashion. What do you think?
Well, I think in general, opening credits have fallen out of fashion, especially on the broadcast networks, where the number of commercials that you have in every hour of television is so much greater now than it was even in the early 90s when The Fresh Prince came on, that the creators of these shows have to basically decide, do I want to devote 60 to 90 seconds to a catchy theme song, or do I want to devote those 60 to 90 seconds to packing in more story and more jokes? And in almost every case, they pick the story and the jokes, and I understand why. And so that means big opening credit sequences are almost entirely the province of cable shows now, and they don't make shows like The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air on HBO or FX.
Then the other category, opening credits as explicator of theme. Here is one fine, enduring example, the theme from Star Trek.
Space, a final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Okay, so that's kind of an explainer, but it also gives us the theme.
Yeah, it gives you a sense of what the show is about, not just in terms of here are these guys on this mission, but just the scope of the show, and we're going to explore and we're going to see what happens. And a lot of times what will happen is we'll come upon an alien planet where the aliens have weird ridges on their foreheads or are reenacting some period of American history so we can use costumes from the studio's trunk. But regardless, the credit sequence gives you this sense of grandeur that the show sometimes lived up to and sometimes did not.
How about opening credits as setter of mood? This was your other category. What are some examples of that?
Do you remember shows like Full House and Perfect Strangers in the 80s?
Yeah.
Those would always have these big sweeping scores and, you know, sappy music and people, you know, going out to the park or they're sailing on a boat on Lake Michigan or whatever. And it really didn't necessarily convey the mood of the show itself, but it created this idea of how they wanted you to feel. So they want you to feel attached to Cousin Larry and Balky or Uncle Jesse and the rest of the Full House gang and think, these are part of my family and I'm excited and there's something emotional here, even though the actual show is just full of wacky hijinks for the most part.
We're talking about some of the most persistent earworms ever to hit American popular culture, the TV opening theme song. TV critic Alan Sepinwall is with us. He and his colleagues at HitFix came up with a list of the 25 greatest opening sequences of all time, including this one.
No one told you life was gonna be this way. Job's a joke, you broke. Your love life's the other way. It's like you're always stuck in second gear.
That cast went through many hairstyles and many different looks over the years, and they never changed that original theme because the shots of them playing in the fountain and having fun were really all they ultimately needed.
That just reminded me of how often there are songs that we associate with the program. They can be so beloved, like I'm thinking Everybody Knows Your Name from Cheers, for example,
sure.
or The Sopranos. But those musicians never really transcended those television shows. I mean, it's not as if they became pop hits. They just seem confined to this universe of TV shows.
Well, I mean, I remember hearing the Friends theme on the radio a lot in the 90s and the Cheers theme a lot on the radio in the 80s, and certainly Greatest American Hero became a pop hit. I had the 45 record of that forever. So it does happen on occasion. It doesn't happen as much anymore, but, you know, the Rembrandts who did that Friends theme, they were able to ride that success for a little bit, and it to show how sticky that theme is, when it started playing and they get to the point where you're supposed to clap, I clapped. I could not stop myself.
So did everybody in the studio.
Yep.
Alan, what role, when I think of great opening sequences today, I think of HBO, you know, some terrific opening sequence programs from The Sopranos, from 6 Feet Under. What role did HBO play in reviving the art of the title sequence?
They played a big role because, again, around the time that HBO started making these original series like Oz and The Sopranos and Sex and the City in the late 90s, the networks had already started moving away from the credits. So the only place for a while where you could do these was on this channel that didn't have commercials. And so you've got 60 whole minutes to play with, and almost none of these shows are ever 60 minutes long. So that's now become, you know, something you expect from HBO shows, and sometimes it's disappointing when they don't live up to that. Deadwood is one of the greatest HBO shows ever, and I watch that, and every single time you get up to the opening credits, I kind of look away and do something else and wait for them to be over, which I don't feel about Sopranos or more recently something like True Detective.
In terms of music, what are some of the most memorable theme songs in television history?
Rockford Files, MASH, Hawaii Five-0, Friends theme, definitely Cheers theme, Addams Family, Batman, a lot of ones from the 60s, the Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and absolutely the two from the Sherwood Schwartz shows, Gilligan's Island and Brady Bunch. Those shows will in some way live on long past either of us just because of those two songs.
Well, Alan Sepinwall, thank you so much for walking us down TV's memory lane.
Thanks for having me.
Here's a story.
TV critic Alan Sepinwall. He and his colleagues at HitFix compiled a list of the 25 greatest TV opening sequences of all time. You'll find that list at nhpr.org.